And one of the things that goes along with this time of year, especially if we live in a forested area, is the threat of bushfires. And one of the images that I'd like to use tonight to help us to approach the teaching of the Buddha is the image of the approach of a bushfire anywhere. And it's not only in Australia that bushfires happen. And even if you haven't experienced it personally, you'll know that bushfires create a lot of danger and also can cause havoc, destruction and loss of life. And when a bushfire is approaching, before the actual fire front reaches an area, sparks from the fire are pushed ahead of the actual fire front. And these sparks are carried on the wind which the fire itself generates. And it's very often these sparks that go ahead of the fire which actually ignite vegetation before the actual fire front comes. And also these sparks which get into the crevices, into the gutters, into the foliage around a house, which actually start the fire at that house or those premises and start the burning long before the fire front actually comes. So one of the things that you have to do long before the fire front gets there and when the sparks are being pushed ahead is that you wet down the whole area. You wet down the roof and the eaves and the verandas and the walls and all the gardens and vegetation around the building so that when the sparks land, that they land onto a damp area and they don't have anything that they can ignite. And the sparks themselves carry heat with them. The sparks themselves carry the fire. And even when they land on a burnt area, particularly if they're big sparks and if they're being fanned by the wind that's coming behind them, they may not be extinguished immediately. Even though they're landing on the damp area and there's nothing to support their ignition, they'll continue to burn until they burn up their own fuel. But because they're not fed by new fuel, they eventually go out and they don't cause any damage. And if you have a fire front coming towards you, it's not enough just to wet down once. You have to do it continuously until it's too hot to stay out, or until the fire front passes, may not come directly to the place where you are, may pass some distance away, and the sparks are all that actually arrives on your doorstep. But you can't stop until the fire has moved completely out of your area. Now this image of damping down and preventing any further damage happening, and the image that the sparks carry within them their own fire and they have to burn up, even if it's damp around them, they don't go out immediately. This is a very good image to hold in the mind to understand what we're doing in terms of trying to live a deliberate life in cultivating the spiritual path, trying to develop a lifestyle and an understanding of life that conforms with reality, but which doesn't guarantee that we won't have ups and downs that we have to deal with in our life, that we won't have fire fronts and sparks coming into our territory. But when we live in a deliberate way, and especially when we use the guidance given to us by the Buddha to cultivate a strong and stable inner environment, that is our mental environment, our mental and emotional environment, we have the capacity to set up a situation where even when those sparks come right up to the doorstep, they fall on damp ground and they don't ignite further fuel and create havoc. The Buddha explained in the big picture of life, in terms of the eight worldly winds which come into all our lives, regardless of who we are and how well we practice, whether we're a good person or we're just bumbling along without trying to consciously cultivate wholesomeness and wisdom in our life, or whether we're downright mean and rotten and don't care about the quality of our life and our relationships. These eight worldly winds will blow on all of us. And these are explained as a pair of opposites. And the opposites are praise and blame, loss and gain, fame and ill fame, or even obscurity, which some people find even worse than even being notorious, but least well known, and happiness and unhappiness. Now, these are just labels to help us to have a sense of these opposites which arise in the world and which arise in our experience in different degrees, in different combinations from time to time. The Buddha uses these to establish an understanding that these go along with life, these ups and these downs, in different degrees, in different ways, and as I said, in different combinations. But when they arise in our own life, we very often think that something's gone wrong, that it shouldn't happen. It's a mistake. It's not fair. Where in fact, if we open our eyes and look around, we'll see that this is what life contains for everyone in different degrees and combinations. And it provides us with the bigger picture of what life contains. And what we're dealing with in our spiritual life is not being thinking that we'll be able to avoid these or eradicate them completely. What we're trying to develop is an understanding of them, what causes them, and how we can deal with them, how we can make peace with them, how we can learn from them when they arise in our own life. And it's important to understand that we're not just trying to learn how to deal with and make peace with the bad things that happen to us, because we can be swept away just as much by the good things that happen, the things that happen which we've been told, which we assume, which other people think automatically guarantee happiness, such as fame, such as gain. We see examples all around us of people who've apparently had all of those things and who aren't happy, who haven't been able to use those things in a way which has improved their sense of life and where they fit in. It hasn't helped them to find peace with life. And so, in the Buddha's teaching, it's about understanding the whole range of experience that is possible. and learning to understand it all from our own personal perspective. We're taking the universal, this happens to everyone, it can happen at any time, but what does it mean for me? Now, in the image of the bushfire coming, this context, this environment, this external world is like the bushfire that's coming onto our property. And we may have done nothing to start the fire. We may have done everything that's needed to protect our property. We've got fire breaks, we've cleared the bush, we've done everything right. And yet, because of the right conditions, a fire starts somewhere else. The wind brings it towards us. The temperature is hot that day. And all of those conditions, if you like, conspire against us to bring the fire onto our doorstep. We can't stop the fire. But because of the preparation that we've done and because of understanding that the fire can come onto our doorstep, we're prepared and we can work with it, with that situation. And it's the same with the work that we do in the spiritual life. We can't stop the things happening that we don't like, or we can't stop the good things happening that we may have worked very hard to produce. What's important is how we deal with it when it arises. And what's important is the preparation that we do so that we're ready to meet that thing with skill and with strength of mind, with wisdom and with compassion. And the Buddha has given us ways to do that. And in the Noble Eightfold Path, the first part of the training of the mind is to cultivate wholesomeness by living within the boundaries of the five precepts. And the fundamental precept, to try to live as harmlessly as possible, as honestly as possible, as truthfully as possible, living with integrity so that how we live in the world reflects our inner life and our inner life reflects the way that we operate in the world. And the five precepts are just the basic guidelines, they point to those areas in our everyday experience where we need to pay special attention, where we need to watch the arising of selfishness, watch for it and see what it brings into our life, whether it brings ease or distress, and how we can work with our selfishness, how we can work to be more at peace with ourselves and more at peace with others. And so this fundamental precept of harmlessness and honesty and integrity, that's what protects us and builds relationships. When we start to meditate, we start to look into the mind and come closer to the experience of ourself. Even when we try to do the simple practice of watching the breath, when we cultivate that practice, we start to see what comes between ourselves, the awareness of the breath and the breath. What is it that stops us from being able to focus on the breath? What is it that pulls us away from that simple object? It may be that we're thinking about something that seems important, our work or our family, or something that's worrying us at the moment. It may be that we're preoccupied with how the body feels. It's too uncomfortable, it's too hot, and it prevents us from just focusing on the breath and being at peace with doing that. It may be that we find that the breath is boring, and that attitude of the breath is boring has a subtle quality of negativity, aversion in it. And as we start to practice over time, we see that that subtle quality of aversion is present so often in whatever we're doing. Everything has that quality of not being good enough, not being interesting enough, no matter what we're doing. And as we cultivate meditation, we discover what is happening in the mind that's preventing us from being at ease with life, that's preventing us from having a direct experience of this moment. When we're trying to have a direct experience of the breath, whatever comes between us and that direct experience, whatever interferes with the focus of awareness on the breath, that is what's coming between us and the direct experience of every moment of our life. That's what we add to every moment of our life from the past, from our conditioning, from what happened last time, from what we're bringing to this moment. We're adding it on to what's in this moment directly. It's only when we cultivate the mind in meditation that we start to have a much clearer and more accurate picture of what we are carrying with us to each moment, and how that is colouring the moment, no matter what else it actually contains. So we know this most clearly, for example, when we're in a bad mood and something that we usually enjoy just doesn't feel good today because of the bad mood that we're in before we eat it or see it or do it. This mood that we're feeling because it's a strong negative mood, this is what the mind contains moment after moment after moment. And what prevents us very often from being at peace in the moment. There's nothing wrong with now. There's nothing wrong with this person. There's nothing wrong with this food. There's nothing wrong with as it is. But what we add to it, what we bring to it, makes it a problem. And when we practiced in the meditation, trying to relax the body and relax the mind and come into the moment just as it is, watch the breath just as it is, have a direct experience, a direct connection of the breath just as it is in this moment. If we're able to do that, we find that there's a delightful feeling that arises from within the mind itself, regardless of how hot it is, regardless of whatever else is going on, whatever sounds are going on around us, whatever things we've got to do after we leave here. Just in this moment of being completely with the breath, focusing absolutely on the breath, that has a delightful feeling. And if we're able to do that moment after moment, that delightful feeling grows. And the actual experience of the moment is that it's wonderful. It's complete. It's enough. Nothing is missing. And not only that nothing is missing, there's no problem. The problems that we have with our life, in the world, with other people, at that moment, they don't exist. In fact, if we can focus completely and directly on the breath to the point where the world fades away, the world is only that pleasant feeling, only the breath at that moment. And to give the mind that experience is to not only refresh the mind, but to provide it with the strength that it needs to recover from the stress of living, and not only to recover from it, but to build up a storehouse of strength that is there to act as a cushion, as a companion, as a help to deal with whatever we have to deal with in our life. When we cease our meditation, the world arises again. The world of our problems, the world of our difficulties, the world of pain in the body or whatever it is. It's not that the quality of our meditation, when it's very good, gets rid of all those problems forever. But for the time that we're able to focus and to have that pleasant feeling and to be completely with the meditation object, the rest of the world has gone. And however much we can provide the mind with that kind of support and relief, that much we are able to rejuvenate the mind. If we do it regularly, two things arise. First of all, we have this wonderful confidence that we have access to this peace of mind, this rejuvenation of mind, this strength of mind. We can access that no matter what else is happening in our life. It's a source of comfort. It's a source of energy. It gives us the sense that we can face life again because we have this inner resource that we can access. And then just the process itself provides us with a top-up to the strength that we need to deal with life. And because we have that strength, whatever we have to face in life, we face with much more confidence that we'll be able to deal with it. When the body is healthy, when we've been exercising, when we've been eating well, when we've been resting, there's a sort of feeling of well-being in which we often feel we could take on the world. When we feel sick, when we feel tired, when we feel run down, we often feel that the smallest task is beyond us. The way that the body affects how we can cope with things is the same with the mind. Only once we develop this inner strength and this inner resource, even if the body is not so strong, not so fit, not so healthy, the mind can override the body. It can't ultimately override the changes that will take place in this body, the changes that will take place that come through ill health or aging or whatever. But as the mind strengthens, purifies, it has the capacity to maintain its ground even in adverse physical conditions. And so again, this is a great source of confidence. We have this inner comfort that we can return to. We don't have to be fearful that we'll lose all our strength, even if our body is no longer able to do what it used to do. And if we maintain our practice and continue to develop the mind through meditation, the ability to develop deep understanding, wisdom, insight into the nature of this mind and this body, that also increases, so that instead of developing our peace of mind as a way of removing ourselves from the flow of life, trying to escape from what's happening, we find that we're more able to accommodate the flow of life without fighting against it. The inner comfort that we have becomes a refuge and an escape, but it's not something that we run to in order to avoid the realities of life. In the way that we practice in meditation, and especially as we start to develop understanding of the way the mind works, this in itself provides a tremendous resource for our own well-being, to understand how the mind works and how we can cooperate with the mind to work through the difficult times that we face, whether it's because of mental stress or physical difficulties. Some people find that their mind races out of control. And we heard recently of someone who was desperate because they couldn't get to sleep. They couldn't turn off their mind. And this is not an uncommon experience. And the idea that we can just turn off the mind, if we've been practicing meditation, if we've been listening to the Buddha's teaching on the nature of the mind, we'll know that the idea of just being able to turn off the mind with willpower is a wrong understanding. It's trying to do something that isn't possible, to just turn off the mind. The mind, we learn through the Buddha's explanation, arises according to causes and conditions. And you experience that in your meditation tonight. If you've been having a very busy day, it's likely that the mind will be very busy when you sit down here to meditate. If you've been feeling very tired and worn out before you came here, when you sit down to meditate, it's likely that the mind will feel very tired and worn out. If you're going through a period of worry and you've been worrying a lot, it's likely when you sit down to meditate that those worries will continue. Those are the causes and conditions that produce the mind right now, the things that have gone on before this moment. That's the way the mind arises, not according to our will, our desire. I want to be peaceful. Well, if we could all just be peaceful when we want to be, we wouldn't need to sit and practice meditation again and again. So the idea that we can just stop the mind when it's racing or get rid of the thoughts that are disturbing us is unrealistic. But once we start to understand how the mind works, we can learn what we can do in order to work with the racing mind. What are the causes and conditions that produce that racing mind? And what are the causes and conditions that help it to calm down? If we're feeding the mind and stimulating the mind continuously, if we're giving it very intense stimulation continuously, then we can't expect that the mind will be able to calm down until we allow the momentum of the mind to wear out. Just like the spark that's coming, that's being blown from the bushfire ahead of the main fire, that spark contains its own fuel. And even when it lands on the damp ground, even if it's not fed in the moment when it lands, it has its own fuel that it's carrying with us, and it has to burn until that's all gone. Now, we allow that to burn up its fuel, but we don't add more fuel. First of all, we don't have dry ground that it lands on, so that it can find some new fuel on that spot and with its existing flame to ignite that fuel. And also, not only do we not have the fuel there, we have moisture, dampness, coolness, so that all the conditions that would allow that flame to continue to burn are gone. And so the flame burns only with the fuel that it brought with it, and then it dies out. So this is what happens with the mind. If we are stimulating the mind, if we are feeding the mind, if we're thinking obsessively around one issue or around a topic or a situation, and we keep feeding information about that situation to the mind, then that's adding new fuel to the mind. We can't expect that it will just stop. We have to remove the fuel, remove the stimulation, remove the information, the things that we're feeding the mind. And then we have to deal with the movement of the mind itself. That's the obsessive thinking. Every thought in the mind is a movement, a mental movement, and every movement is a source of friction in the mind, even when it's a pleasant thought. So we may be obsessed with something that's pleasant, something that we want, something that we desire, something that we're obsessed with getting, and so all of our thoughts are around how we can get that thing. And it seems to be pleasant. It seems to be wonderful. But when we start to meditate and come closer to the direct experience of those thoughts, we see that each thought, no matter how pleasant the content or how pleasant the object that it's directed towards, is actually a source of friction. And it's only when we have the other experience of the mind at peace, the mind at rest on an object, and experience the pleasant feeling that arises from within the mind itself in that moment of stillness, in that moment of non-friction, that we realize what we're doing to the mind by constantly moving over objects from one thought to the next. Now, if the mind is already obsessively thinking and already wound up to the extent that we can't sleep, we can't get peace, we can't get rest, then we have to address the bigger picture, because the momentum of those thoughts will already be there. So we have to remove the fuel that is feeding those thoughts. And then we have to understand that those thoughts will contain their own fuel, and they will have to burn up that fuel, use up that friction, before there is stillness, before there is peace. If we've been practicing and developing a direct understanding of the way the mind works, then when we get into those situations in our life which are fraught with difficulty, where the mind seems to be racing along against our better interests, we will not only understand what we can and can't accomplish, but we'll also understand that it takes time to achieve the result of peace, stillness, calm. Understanding that these things take time and that we need to be patient is a wonderful support. Sometimes we get very discouraged because we're doing all the right things, but we're not getting the result that we expected to get. And it's only that we haven't been doing it long enough. We haven't been persevering. We haven't been patient enough. The result that we're seeking is just round the bend. We just have to keep doing what we're doing until the result materializes. Now, unless we've been practicing and cultivating this understanding, before we get into a very difficult situation, it's highly unlikely that we'll stumble across these truths on our own. And unless we've got good friends who are wise and understand the way of the mind, then we may find that there seems to be no way out of the situation that we're in. And people get very desperate when they feel they have no way out, have no alternative but the suffering that they're stuck in. And that's, again, even if we haven't got all the understanding about the nature of the mind, to reflect that in the bigger picture, praise and blame are part of the same scheme of things. Happiness and unhappiness arise in life, maybe not simultaneously, but certainly one after the other, that nothing stays the same. Everything is in a process of changing into something else. And so the terrible situation that we seem to be stuck in right now is not going to last forever. And if we have cultivated at least that understanding that there is something apart from the thing that I'm experiencing right now, that can be a great comfort. And again, if we're thinking that this shouldn't happen to me, or something must be wrong, or I must be terrible to have this happen to me, again, to know that this is what happens for everyone. These are just the realities of life. That can also help us to apply ourselves to looking for solutions, to looking to ways of dealing with the situation, rather than fighting against it. And one of those solutions may be to accept this is what we've got, this is what we've got to deal with, what can I do about it? So in the Buddha's teaching, we cultivate the mind and we allow the mind to grow in goodness, grow in wisdom, and grow in compassion, so that that stays not only or merely as a mental state, but it starts to express itself in our speech and our action. And this is how we see that the Noble Eightfold Path, though it seems to be a linear path of sila, virtue, samadhi, meditation and wisdom, panya, that this is actually a circular path, because the more we develop the mind in peaceful states, the more wisdom develops. The peaceful states are supported by the goodness of our life. The more we understand the way things work, the more we naturally live in accordance with Dharma. That is, we try to live in accordance with nature rather than fighting against nature. And this necessarily expresses itself in trying to live harmlessly, peacefully, at ease with ourselves and at ease with others. we're very fortunate to have the path of practice so clearly explained to us by the Buddha, and to have friends who are practicing and who can show us by their example that this path works. And if we are in a situation where we feel that there's no way out, then it's a wonderful thing to know that we can have help and guidance from others. But for all of us, the greatest refuge that we can have is our own mind. The Buddha said that there's no greater help, no greater help even than one's parents or one's closest relations, than one's own developed mind. And that developed mind means not only developed in calm states, but also developed in wisdom. But without developing the calm states, it's very difficult to develop wisdom. Because until we experience directly the potential of this mind to be a source of happiness, to be a source of comfort, to be a source of refuge, even when things in our outer life, outer circumstances, seem completely out of control, then we'll constantly try to manipulate the outer conditions to try to get them to be the way we want them to be. And that is a hopeless task. But on the other hand, it is possible to work with this mind and develop an inner life, which is a support no matter what is happening in our outer conditions. And ultimately, all of us are going to face the outer condition which we can't do anything about, and that is our death. We might be skillful throughout our outer life getting things the way that we think they should be or we want them to be, but ultimately there's going to come a time when we aren't going to be able to change what is happening to us. It will be then that the only refuge that we'll have is the inner environment which we've cultivated through the course of our life. Meditation is the really indispensable tool to help us to do that cultivation gradually, little by little, to uncover the wealth that the mind contains. So for all of you, I encourage you to think of this image that we can't stop the bushfire coming onto our doorstep, but by working with our inner environment, we can prepare the ground so that what comes to our doorstep, even if it burns with its own fire, with its own fuel, doesn't continue to burn once it reaches our dampened down ground. That is the mind that's ready to receive whatever life has to throw at us. May this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantan Abhivademi Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sawakasang.